Hello and welcome to tonight's Arena, coming to you as part of the 2025 Dublin Book Festival. Now you're over-egging it. You didn't do that in rehearsal. Welcome along to 1WML here in Windmill Lane, the glorious surrounds of the lovely 1WML building here. We're here for a special reason, to celebrate the 100th issue of Ireland's best-loved literary journal, the Dublin Review. It's a quarterly publication of essays, memoir and fiction from Irish and international writers, giving voice to new and established writers. Over the years, the Dublin Review has published everyone from Anne Enright, Colm Tobin and Claire Keegan to Neisha Dolan, Glenn Patterson and Sally Rooney. We're delighted that the journal's founder and editor, Brendan Barrington, joins me on stage this evening, along with some of its contributors over the past 100 issues, Sarah Baum, Patrick Frayne, Darren the Grifa and Mark O'Connell. We also have music from two people who've been described as two of Ireland's most captivating contemporary folk artists. That's Sean McAlane and Cuivín O'Riola. They'll be launching their album this Saturday at the National Concert Hall, and we're going to hear from them later on in the show. Brendan, it makes sense that I start with you this evening. You're the editor and the founder, originally a New Yorker, but crucially you had an Irish passport. So how did you end up coming here, and how did that then lead you to starting the Dublin Review?
I came here with no great plans and no intention of spending 30 years, which I've now done in Dublin. I came just because I was working as a journalist in Washington, D.C. after university, and I quickly realized that I wasn't a journalist and that I didn't want to live in Washington, D.C. So both sort of pillars of my post-college life were quickly revealed to be wobbly. And I had an Irish passport. My father was Irish, many lovely Irish relatives. And I thought, okay, I'll get out of the United States for a while and see what happens. I never thought I'd be sitting here 30 years later, but I'm very happy to be here.
Talk to me a little bit about the establishment then of the journal itself. What was the scene like at that point in the two or three years before you thought about starting something like this?
Yeah, so we're talking the mid to late 1990s. I'd moved to Dublin with great expectations of Ireland's remarkable literary culture, and they were completely realized in every way, except that I was disappointed in the relative lack of literary periodicals in Ireland. There were a couple of very interesting ones, but they'd come out, and then the next issue wouldn't come out for another year and a half. And there was a lot of poetry journals, but prose I felt was just simply underserved. And so I used to sort of grumble about this and wonder about it. And then at some point, I was working for a small publishing house at the time, so I was developing editorial chops and contacts. And eventually I thought I should try to create the journal that I wish, when I go into Books Upstairs, the journal I wish was sitting there. I could try to create it myself. And luckily at that time, the Arts Council's funding was improving year on year. The economy was doing well. This is now 1999, 2000. And so the Arts Council was willing to take a chance on me as a sort of startup. And they've supported the journal ever since. And I'm glad for the opportunity to thank them for 25 years of extraordinary support for the Dublin Review.
And what was that journal that you wish existed at that point in 1998, 1999?
I suppose I was a reader of the New York Review of Books, the London Review of Books, Granta. There were various American quarterlies that I respected, where nonfiction, writerly nonfiction, sat alongside fiction. And what I missed in Irish culture at that time, and there were a couple of extremely honorable exceptions of Irish fiction writers who were also doing extraordinary work in the essay form. But that was absolutely not the norm. Writing essays, writing kind of long form criticism, reportage, was something that most Irish fiction writers, poets, playwrights simply did not do. And I wanted to try to encourage them to do it, and that was the sort of work I wanted to publish in the Dublin Review, alongside brilliant short stories, which I knew there would be no problem finding brilliant short stories. The challenge was to create a space for brilliant writerly nonfiction.
The look of it was important as well, wasn't it? Because it has maintained this uniform look all the way through, to the point where they look beautiful on my shelf at home, all sitting one next to each other.
Yeah, and that's a design by David Smith of Atelier, and Oren Day, his colleague, continues to be our designer. It has changed hardly at all over the years. We've made a couple of small tweaks, minor improvements, but with the design and really with everything about the Dublin Review, I started in a way that I wanted it to be sustainable. I wanted it to be something that with myself and, you know, the team has never been larger than three people. It's more often than not been two people. With that tiny team and working part-time, because I've always had another job as well, I wanted it to be something that we could produce without... I didn't want to be spending 5 hours every quarter thinking about, or 50 hours thinking about jacket designs. So beautiful, simple typographic design. And that is the ethos that's informed everything. Simplicity, maximum simplicity, to create as much time as possible for me to do the important work of trying to find great writing and edit it.
I want to see if maybe any one of our panelists wants to talk about this. What is it about those kind of long-form essays and that kind of reportage that appeals to you as writers? Who wants to have a go at that first? Nobody, that's helpful. Great, thanks.
Well, I'm happy to come in. Like, I think the long-form kind of essay, like Brendan says, wasn't a huge thing in Ireland. And my day job is as a journalist, and there's a different kind of slant to journalism than to kind of essays and kind of literary nonfiction. It's crossovers. Like, there's amazingly literary journalism that's always been produced in Ireland. But with the long-form nonfiction, there's something more exploratory, and there's something that you can, if you compare, like, the essay to, like, opinion journalism, like, an opinion piece tends to be someone trying to tell you something they already know. Essays as a form, and like personal, whether they're personal essays or long-form criticism or long-form reportage, they tend to be more exploratory. The person doesn't know what they're going to end up with. They often start with a question. You know, like if it's a bit of reportage, it's like, what's happening over there? If it's personal essay, it's, why do I think that? And then you kind of start and you start delving into it. Or, why do I love this thing? You know, I've written a lot of essays over the years about things I'm either interested in, my own thought process, or kind of stuff I like. And there aren't that much space for that in kind of newspapers. So for me, it was just great to be able to go longer on things.
What about you, Sarah? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, for me, it's been kind of like, it's when I want to write an account of something sort of interesting or unusual that's happened to me. It's always been kind of about a set of circumstances or like a sequence of experiences that are outside of my norm. But then it's also, so it's just, it's a way of creating a record of that. But it's also been a way to kind of look at it from different angles, I suppose, to bring in, I guess, other stories and other perspectives, or to look at it through the lens of history or of... the songwriter Joanna Newsom said this lovely thing about how... for her, the role of an artist is to kind of see how things are connected in the world and to lasso them all together into the same place. And I always think of that if I'm trying to write a long-form essay. I'm trying to trying to make connections between things and get them all together in the same place at the same time.
Brendan has a reputation, I'm sure he won't mind me saying this, as being a bit of a formidable editor. So what's it like being edited by him, and how does that process work? Mark, maybe you'll take that one.
Yeah, I'm very aware that Brendan has this reputation, and I'm sure it's very well earned. But for me, I think like most writers, actually, I really like being edited. I really like being edited by good editors, and I've been lucky to work mostly with good editors. But for me, Brendan is formidable for sure, but also... I always think of it in terms of, like, permission. You know, the stuff that I wrote for the Dublin Review, the stuff that I wrote for Brendan, I would almost say with Brendan, there's a really, like, collaborative kind of aspect to it, which, you know, for some writers maybe is difficult or not what they want. But for me, I relish that stuff. And when I think about the pieces that I've written for the Dublin Review And also the pieces that I've failed to write for the Dublin Review, actually. That's, you know, when you guys were talking, I was thinking of, like, for me, the Dublin Review is, I can see Brendan sort of smiling wryly here, but, like, for me, the Dublin Review is a place where I would go to write things that might not work, you know? The ideas that are a bit like, well, let's just see, you know?
And are those pieces that you started to write and then at somewhere throughout the process you realised this
yeah,
isn't going to work?
Yeah, things that are kind of hard conceptually that, like, you know, pieces that are not necessary. Are you just going to work them out in the writing or not at all? And sometimes they do work out in the writing and sometimes they don't go anywhere because the ideas are kind of too tricky, you know? That's how I would think of the kind of writing that I would do for the Dublin Review.
Throughout
stuff that's a bit maybe risky to even begin with.
Throughout the course of the evening, all of our panelists are going to read something that they have written for the Dublin Review at some point. Darren, I'm going to start with you. The essay was The Dissection Room, and it was your touch on the idea of what's called déjà rêvé, the idea a dream subsequently manifests itself in reality. Is that fair enough? Is that how that process worked for you with this?
I think that's the concept of it, is when you have a dream and then bizarrely in real life you witness in some way the dream coming true before your eyes. And that was bizarrely something that did happen to me when I was 17. I went to university to study dentistry. And when I walked into the dissection room on the first morning, I recognised the room because I'd had an extremely vivid dream that blew me away at the time, just a few months before that, where I was entering that room. And it was exactly the same. And I was completely freaked out. So that was, I think, the idea that I was trying to explore in this essay was, why do I keep being drawn back to that room? And yeah, that's kind of how it starts. In the dissection room, our group nodded at each other politely, like old ladies around a fresh pot of tea. You first. No, please, after you. Eventually, one lavishly freckled boy chose a scalpel and folded the white sheet from the cadaver's throat to the waist. We all leaned forwards over the cold expanse of human skin. Above a round little tummy, the cadaver's small breasts sagged softly, speckled with liver spots. The boy held the blade over the old woman's body for one trembling moment, and then he brought it down. We stared, mouths open, enchanted. And then, by silent agreement, we began to take turns cutting the old woman. I watched hand after hand press scalpel to skin, and I tried to join in, poking ineffectually at flesh that seemed uncannily like tinned tuna, grey and layered, before seeing the skin lifting from the ribcage in two clean flaps, opening like the wings of a moth.
Briefly, what was it like being edited by Brendan, as far as you were concerned?
Oh, fantastic. I suppose for me, it's maybe different from the other writers on this panel in that I was, artistically, I was used to writing poetry. And I started to kind of feel a curiosity about trying something longer. The first time that I sent a piece to Brendan, it was turned down. And that was good, because that encouraged me to think harder and try again and write something better. And that's always how I feel about the Dublin Review. First of all, as a reader, I absolutely love reading it. And then as a writer, it always pushes me. I always want to think of the subject of a really good piece that I can send to Brendan. So it's good to have that to aim for, I think, as a writer.
Okay, we'll be back with our panel and with Brendan in a couple of minutes, but we're going to take some music now. This Saturday at the National Concert Hall, two of Ireland's most inventive musicians take the stage. They are violinist Caoimhín O'Reilly and multi-instrumentalist Sean McErlane, and they're launching their album Old Segosia with a live performance that blends Irish traditional music with improvisation and experimental soundscapes. We're delighted they've joined us here this evening ahead of the performance. Kevin Caoimhín, maybe you'll take this one. Just tell us, how did this whole thing come about?
Well, myself and Sean are old pals now for many years, and while we've made music together in a band called This Is How We Fly, it's been really lovely to just celebrate our friendship through this project and explore a different way of making music. So that's the result is this album that it's coming out on Friday, I think.
You're in for a treat for two reasons, because we were listening to the sound check earlier on, and the acoustics in this room are absolutely fantastic. What are you going to play for us?
We're going to play a song called Jeu de Plume.
That is Sean McErlane and Caoimhín O'Reilly. The album is Old Segosia. It is out this coming Friday, the 7th of November. And details of the National Concert Hall gig this Saturday at nch.ie. You're listening to Arena, coming to you live from this year's Dublin Book Festival. And we are back after these. You are very welcome back to Wednesday night's Arena, coming to you from 1WML in the Windmill Quarter of Dublin. We're here as part of the Dublin Book Festival. This evening we're marking the 100th issue of the Dublin Review. My guests are editor Brendan Barrington and writers Sarah Baum, Mark O'Connell, Darren Negrifa and Patrick Frayne. Patrick, the day job as a newspaper journalist and a columnist, do you think that helps or hinders you when it comes to foregrounding your own personal experience for the type of thing you've written for the Dublin Review?
It probably does both. Like, I think you get overly fluent as a journalist because that sounds like a humble brag and it's not meant to be. Because you have to write so quickly and so often, you end up being able to finish things really quickly. And as I've learned from working with Brendan, sometimes my stuff isn't as finished as I think it is. And there is something about like thinking of it more like art and thinking of it more like something you have to sit with for a while. And I think one of the interesting things about, I mean, I say this when I talk to writers who ask, like people who are starting out or writing about writing essays, I don't think you should publish everything you write. And I think one of the things as a journalist is you end up publishing almost everything you write because there's this constant machine that's asking you to produce stuff for it. Whereas with, say, the essays, the first essay I wrote for Dublin Review is an essay called Brain Fever, which ended up being in a book I wrote subsequently and is a big part of why that book exists. And that's a book about, like, I'd written personal-ish stuff before, but that's a book about, like, mental health issues I'd had. There's funny bits too, but about mental health issues I had. And I think that was an essay that I needed to sit with and I needed to work with an editor about. And I don't know if it would have served me to have written that at that point for, like, a newspaper. I think I'd have written it too quickly. I'd have written it I kind of without heed or something.
Might you not have written it at all?
I might not have written it. I probably wouldn't have written it at all, actually. So there's something about... and then there's something about sitting with stuff and treating things as, whether they are or not, treating them like they're a little bit more elevated, you know, so that you don't just publish your first draft, or you don't just... I wrote a version of that essay a few years before that I'm really glad I didn't publish because I was also raw, and that's another thing I've learned about personal writing is I think I'd recommend people write about anything they want, but not necessarily publish everything that they write, because there's definitely a line, like, even though so, like, everyone here has written personal things at different points, we don't publish everything and we don't want everything out in the world. Like, there's a line between what should be out there and what shouldn't be. And that's part of what working with a good editor is about as well, as finding where those lines are.
I think that's what you're going to do for us tonight. You're going to read a little something from that?
Yeah, I'm going to read a funnier bit because there's some depressing bits. This is called Hypochondria, and Duren's thing is making me even more hypochondriac. So this is a small section. The essay's written in sections, and they're about kind of different points of psychological ill health I've had. This is called hypochondria. Recently, I found a note in an old pocket. Numb feeling on left side of head. Burning itchy patch on scalp. Red sore eyes. Sharp pain under right arm. Pins and needles in feet. Occasional stomach upset. Bad dreams. Floaters on my vision. Red rash on chest. Erratic heartbeat. It was a note to take to my doctor. I've many notes like this hidden away in faded charity shop jackets. By my late 20s, my neurosis and grief had blossomed into full-blown hypochondria, and my middle-aged doctor began greeting me like an old friend, or probably more accurately, a silent business partner who was helping put his children through college. There was never anything wrong with me, and I spent hundreds each month on doctors and scans and tests that always turned out to be negative. I never had a drug habit or a flashy lifestyle. For a while, I spent my meager earnings on medical tests instead. And then I got broadband, which taught me new facts about life. Did you know that every feeling you have in your body is also potentially a symptom of terminal cancer? It took me several years to realize the futility of my cyberchondria. Then in my 20s, I was pleased and appalled to discover there were several serious hereditary diseases running in my family. So I was dying all along. <That's it.
laughs> A Okay, Brendan, we've had a couple of our panelists talk about that submission and editing process for a piece in the Dublin Review. Talk to us from your point of view as to how that works, because you commission work, but then there's also a huge amount of work that's just submitted to you on spec for every issue.
That's right. We accept submissions from all comers, as do most literary journals, and that's a hugely important part of what we do. One of the jobs of a literary journal, I think, is to discover new writers and to give writers, and when I say new, I define that broadly. It doesn't mean you've necessarily never published anything anywhere, but I think what the sort of process I put writers through can give a young writer is sort of, it's often a first encounter with serious editorial feedback. And in some cases, the first encounter with a readership, you know, not a huge readership, but a very attentive readership, starting with me and then our subscribers and the people who pick up the Dublin Review from time to time. So both of those things have to be there. You have to be, from the start, in order to fill the pages of the Dublin Review at the beginning, I had to approach writers whose work I knew and convince them to write for the Dublin Review. And I knew the first issue, the first two people I approached were Colm Tobin and Anne Enright, because they were the two Irish writers at that time who were writing really brilliant personal and critical essays. And I thought, if I can't get them on board, then this whole concept is fatally flawed. But they both very generously wrote brilliant essays for the first issue. But you can't do that. You can't fill every issue in that way. You have to create a space for new stuff, stuff you've never heard of, stuff you've never contemplated. And that's one of the joys of the job. I mean, it involves a huge amount of reading. It involves sending out a lot of rejection letters, unfortunately. But it's always exciting, even after 25 years, to find a wonderful piece by someone you've never heard of and to start that adventure of trying to figure out, okay, how do you get it into the best possible shape?
You have, from what I see, just as a reader, kind of longer form relationships as well with newer writers, where they have a piece published and then maybe something else turns up in another 12 months on the road towards eventually them publishing a first novel or a first collection of short stories. Is that important?
That's very important. Yeah, it's part of the life cycle of a writer. And now every writer has a different trajectory. And I was thinking about the four writers we have here this evening, and each of them sort of came to the Dublin Review in a slightly different way. And each of them, I'd say for each of them, the sort of writing they've done for the Dublin Review sits differently relative to their other work. That, you know, there's no template. You know, it's a little bit different for everyone. But it's so you have to take everything on its own terms, even though I know I have biases, I have strong tastes and preferences. There are things I know I love. There are whole categories of writing I know I don't love. But even within the constraints of my taste and my biases and my blindnesses, there's just an enormous realm of possibilities. And that's the same for every writer. No two writers who come to the Dublin Review with a piece are in the same place. They might be working on a novel, but they send me an essay. It might be a short story and they're hoping to publish a collection of short stories. It might take 10 years for the collection of short stories to come together. So it's about just being attentive to what's in front of you.
Sarah, I want to come to you next. There's almost invariably a personal aspect to most things that are published in the Dublin Review. Some of them are more intimate than others. Talk to me a little bit about whether you find it easier to write fiction or prose where you foreground personal experience or something in the middle. How has that worked for you?
Well, it's an interesting question because for this event, I looked back at the earliest thing that I'd had published in the Dublin Review, which was a short story, quote unquote, in 2014, which was way back, I guess, when I was very much a baby writer. And it was probably one of the first short stories I had published, not the first, but one of them. And then I didn't publish a book for quite a year or so afterwards. But anyway, I remembered this essay. Sorry, I remembered this story. I can't even call it the right thing. I remembered it as a short story being completely invented and could remember hardly anything about it, in fact. And when I read over it just earlier this week, I was like, oh, yes, I remember that occasion when dot, dot, dot. So it was very much a true account of something that happened in my life. But I remembered it as a short story, and I can't even quite remember now. I can't separate what the true experience was from the embellished experience that I then decided was right. And Brendan and I were talking about this just earlier, and he said, interestingly, that there is a certain kind of a tone, there's some kind of a quality there that separates a piece of fiction from nonfiction. Is that what you said?
Yeah, but I can't define it. And I've been thinking about this for 25 years, and I still couldn't give a coherent account of what the difference is. But I think there is a difference, even with a writer like Sarah. And lots of the most interesting writers at the moment are kind of dancing on the borderlands between fiction and nonfiction. And I feel like the difference is really important, and yet some of the writing I'd love the best is writing where the difference is not actually clear at all.
Yeah. What are you going to read for us tonight? Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I'm going to read from actually an essay that I had published in 2022. And it was based upon, I think there's a bottomless well of opportunities, I think, there's a bottomless well of interest, perhaps, in people's different stories about property. Patrick has a very good essay called Real Estate in the Dublin Review from a good few years back. But this was about a brief and very delusional period of my life when I thought I was able to afford property in the region where I live, which is West Cork. And my partner and I would obsessively look online. And then my partner and I would go and view. I mean, I think we only viewed a couple of places really in the end. And it ended up being a very fruitless experience. But I remember thinking, hey, maybe I can write about it. So the most interesting place we went to see was a collection of sort of structures. It was, anyway, I'm just going to read the introduction to what ended up being the most intriguing property that we visited. In October, my brother-in-law sent me an email with no message, just a link to a private ad that he had seen on Dundeal. The ad seemed to be describing a substantial property for sale in the countryside, not far from where we lived. I can't remember the exact asking price, but it was somewhere in the ballpark of 60K for a couple of acres and a variety of structures. From the photographs, there appeared to be a significant central chapel-like shed and then several smaller cell-like sheds, each with a skinny chimney sticking up like a periscope. It would make a good garden center, the ad said. It was being sold as a commercial property. Then there was a phone number, and in capital letters at the very bottom, note, this property is currently operating as a dwelling place for religious women.
Mark, tell me about your essay, Every Man His Own Shopping Channel. You used the phrase in it, I think, the broken labyrinth of the internet. You were talking about unboxing videos, which people love to watch on YouTube, although they were a relatively new phenomenon at the time that you wrote the piece.
Yeah, it was well ahead of my time there. That was the first piece that I wrote for the Dublin Review. I remember I think it was the first time I met you, Brendan, actually. We went for a drink and you were asking me about like things that I might want to write about. And for some reason, I just blurted out this idea about unboxing videos. I've been watching a lot of these unboxing videos.
How many pints were involved at that point?
Say again?
How many pints were involved at that point?
Not enough, probably, to justify. But I do remember having to explain what these things were. And I think as the explanation went on, you kind of went through waves of skepticism and then maybe acceptance. And yeah, I think I kind of convinced you. Yeah, and it was the first piece that I wrote for the Dublin Review. And it was, in a way, it was the first thing that I did that really kind of mixed these two sort of oil and water modes of, like, you know, in one sense, kind of serious critical writing, which was where I was coming out from at the time. I was sort of emerging from academia, from a kind of a, I suppose, a thwarted academic career at that point. I mixed that mode with the sort of more reflective, first-person, quite personal writing. And that was something that I hadn't really done at that level before. And I remember feeling like a really strong, and this is a really important thing with editors generally, like a good editor is someone who will like call you on, you know, when you've gone too far and when you haven't gone far enough, but also creates a kind of a structure of permission, like a sense of like, yeah, you can do this. And this is actually a, not a crazy thing to do. It might actually work. And so that was definitely one of those.
You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. It's the 100th issue of the Dublin Review that we're celebrating here tonight from the Dublin Book Festival. We'll take a break and we're back after these. And you're very welcome back to Wednesday Night's Arena at 1WML here in Dublin's Docklands. We are marking the 100th issue of the Dublin Review Literary Journal. It's part of this year's Dublin Book Festival, which kicks off today as well. My guests are editor Brendan Barrington, writer Sarah Baum, Mark O'Connell, Patrick Frayne, and Derren Ní Gcríofa. Derren, you talked about the dissection room earlier on and you read from it. That was, I think, winter 2018-19 that it was published. You wrote about Eileen Dove Ní Conaill. And in 2020, you published A Ghost in the Throat, in which, of course, she plays a major role. Does that suggest an element of cross-fertilization, both between essays, maybe poetry, and then eventually what A Ghost in the Throat became?
Yeah, I suppose it does. I suppose maybe it just reveals that I have my certain obsessions and I circle them round and round again. There was a poem about Eileen Dove Ní Conaill and Queen Arthur Lyra in CLASP, my first book of poems in English, which was 2015. So I kind of go round and round, you know, but I was so glad to be able to work through the early ideas that really underpinned A Ghost in the Throat with Brendan with the Dublin Review. And I don't know if I'm getting across quite how pivotal that editorial relationship was for me as a writer. Like, it really was to send a piece of writing in that you've really put your heart into and to have it received with great, like, seriousness, and to have someone work very closely with you on making it as strong as it can be, that just meant so much to me. And there was a sense of, like Mark was saying, like that sense of permission, you know, and that sense of pushing you almost, okay, keep going, you know, and that really meant a lot to me and kind of pushed me to a point where I felt like, okay, maybe I'll try and write something even longer, like a book. So I was so grateful for those experiences with the essays in the Dublin Review.
Had you published anything that wasn't poetry prior to that?
I had published, I'd started to kind of try out some longer pieces. I had written for The Stinging Fly an essay where what I was trying to figure out was, is it possible to inherit a gesture? That was my question. Like, I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And I started trying to puzzle my way around it. And the essay ended up being just as weird as the question was.
was the gesture?
Oh, it wasn't just one gesture. It was the multiple whole idea gestures. Of gesturing. Right. Like, I think for anyone, maybe when you're raising small children and you notice your child doing something that you remember from, like, a grandparent, but you haven't seen in the generation since, you're like, where the hell did that just come from? And it kind of gets you thinking. And I suppose that speaks to what we were talking about earlier, the beginning of a piece like that, that it can often start with a question that you do not have an answer to. You don't go into it wishing to present to the reader, here's my neat solution to this. Like, you're really puzzling it out on the page. And I think that's part of why, for me as a reader, I really, really enjoy reading the Dublin Review, because you do feel that you're puzzling it out with the writer. Like, there's a great essay recently by Darragh McCausland where he links his experiences working closely with people in a really tender way and how memory is linked in scent, or anchored in scent, maybe. And I just kept thinking about it. And I felt as though I was there beside him through the writing, which was so strong. But also, I think because I felt I was thinking alongside him as well. And that's something that Brendan is magnificent at working on as an editor with a writer. And I've had so much experience with that myself.
Mark, you're the last of our panellists to read for us tonight. I think it's Self-Portrait in Five Fears you're going to do. You write about your visceral fear of moths. Hmm. And for those who haven't read the essay, explain to us where that comes from and what that feels like.
Oh, well, I've no idea where it comes from. And in a way, the essay was an attempt to try to get to the bottom of it, or to at least try to get around the edges of it. But it came from, yeah, it just came from this idea that, like, there are so many things about oneself that you just don't understand. And one of the ways in which that sort of expresses itself is these weird, unaccountable fears or phobias. So the essay has a slightly sort of like highfalutin concept, which is that maybe you could create a kind of a self-portrait by just talking about the things that don't quite make sense to you about yourself and that, you know, manifest in fears. It's a failed attempt, or a series of failed attempts to create a kind of a picture of myself. But again, that's the kind of thing that, you know, I would suggest to Brendan, and he would say, yeah, why not? Do it. And in this case, I actually did do it. So, number one, moths, 1979 to present. For as long as I can remember, I have been afraid of moths. The fear is so weirdly urgent, so primally intense, that I feel it must be in some way fundamental. If I were to discover its origins, I might therefore understand a crucial and hitherto encrypted truth about myself. I have no childhood memories, either real or imaginary, that might explain this fear. I don't recall, say, being trapped in a car seat as a toddler while a giant moth thrummed horribly against the side of my little face. I do remember being thoroughly unnerved by a couple of moth-based scenes in The Silence of the Lambs, a specific moth, Acherontia lachesis, better known by its sinister street name, the Death's Head Hawk Moth. But I was 11 when that film was released, and probably at least 13 by the time I saw it, and so I'm guessing that I was by that point too old for those scenes to have done any major rewiring of my tender psychic circuitry. I think it's precisely because this moth fear is so random and unaccountable that it seems to offer the prospect of a kind of psychological skeleton key, which is, of course, either the illusion of a prospect or the prospect of an illusion. Spoiler alert, I don't figure it out.
Brendan, so here we are, 100 issues later. Talk to me maybe a little bit about the scene now for Irish literary journals in comparison to where it was before you set it up. I know the phrase golden age is an overused and hackneyed one, but are we living through one of them right now?
I don't know if I'd use the term golden age, but I'd say things are better, livelier, more professional, more diverse, and more interesting in Irish journals than certainly at any time in the past 25 years. And I ought to be a better historian of this realm than I am. So I can't say with any real confidence, but my sense is that, you know, there was a period in the mid 20th century when there were a number of pretty lively literary periodicals like The Bell, The Dublin Magazine. There were a number of them. And that is considered a sort of a mini golden age. And then you'd probably before that have to go back to the 18th century, you know, when there was all these things were done in very, very different ways. So it's arguably as good as it's ever been. I think we can still do better, but it's been brilliant to see the growth of this field because, as I think I said earlier, when I started the Dublin Review, there wasn't that much going on. And it seemed a strange lacuna in an otherwise, you know, eternally vibrant literary culture. And again, I have to mention the Arts Council again. The Arts Council has been central to the birth and the development of a number of periodicals in recent years. And, you know, without their support, it wouldn't be possible. And it's just great to see that Ireland can support so many interesting, and each of them has its own editorial sort of vibe, its own tastes, its own character, its own tone. And that's brilliant. You know, it's just great to see that it's so much stronger now.
Given the deeply personal nature of quite a lot of the writing in the Dublin Review, do you ever feel like a therapist or a confessor sometimes?
I think the editor-author relationship does have a therapeutic... there is a definite analogy to therapy, and it doesn't depend on the piece itself being very, very personal or revealing, although a lot of the essays and fiction we publish does, I think, excavate, and we've heard examples this evening. It's excavatory. Do you know, that's the sort of writing I love the best, writing that goes deep. But even with different sorts of pieces that aren't especially excavatory, an editor's relationship with a writer, I think, does have a lot in common with a kind of therapeutic relationship. And when I started as an editor, that was probably what I was worst at. I always felt confident about working with sentences and paragraphs. I wasn't great at working with human beings. And I think I've got better at that over the years. And it's utterly essential. If you want to get the best work out of people, you've got to understand where they're coming from, meet them where they are, and tailor your approach. And that's one of the reasons I'm still doing this after 25 years, is that every single time it's different and exciting in fresh ways. It never feels like I'm doing the same thing twice.
Sadly, unfortunately, that is where we have to finish up for tonight. Before I do, there are a number of people I have to say thank you to. Thank you to everybody who came here tonight. Thank you to our audience. We are here in 1WML in the new Windmill Quarter in Dublin. Thanks to Rory and everybody here in the Windmill Quarter for this gorgeous and wonderful venue, which I've never been to before, and I hope that we'll be back doing something here again in soon. I want to thank our wonderful audience here, to you at home for listening, to our panel, Brendan Barrington, Mark O'Connell, Dermot Grifa, Sarah Baum, and Patrick Frayn, and Julianne and everybody at the Dublin Book Festival. Maybe put your hands together for those, please. The 100th issue of the Dublin Review is available now. This evening's broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. Our engineers were Paddy Kearney, Mark Dwyer and Damien Gavigan. The show was researched by Declan Burke and produced by Shan O'Gorman. To play us out again, we're going to be joined by our musicians Sean McElhane and Cuivín O'Riola. They're going to play us out the new album Old Segosia. It will be available on vinyl and digital this coming Friday, the 7th of November, and they'll be in the National Concert Hall this coming Saturday. nch.ie is where you'll find all of the details for that. I'll talk to you again on tomorrow night's Arena here on Radio 1 from 7 o'clock. But to finish us out, please put your hands together for Sean McElhane and Cuivín O'Riola. Thank you. Mm-hmm.